Kansas. I wasn't in Kansas. I was on the phone. So.
Well, you can't travel fast.
You would think, but well, there was an interview where halfway in the interview they interrupted me and they did their regular weekly feature, was where they would actually look at a so-called contradiction in the Bible and show you how it's not a contradiction. You know, and years ago I got this publication from an atheist organization in Redmond, Washington, and it's called 138 Contradictions in the Bible, and how atheists frequently quote those contradictions as proof that the Bible can't be the inspired Word of God. And every one of them is an easy resolution. But I was wondering that maybe it'd be worth our while sometime in the class every once in a while to pick one of those and just see how well you do at resolving them. So, because after all, it's just a matter of time before somebody puts you on the spot with one of those. So if that's something you're interested in, I'll talk to Dave and Ross and Mark about maybe how we can make that happen as part of the class. Just kind of like we do the testimonies, and maybe we could do something like that. So that's how my morning began today. And I left all my notes on the neutrino thing at home because I figured the thing would blow over, right? I mean, it's not going to last long. Well, I walk into the class here and I ran into five people who say, hey, you got to talk about this. Well, the news is I already have. It's a podcast that's posted on our website. So you can pick up one of your little iPhones or smartphone and download for free the Reasons to Believe app, and you can listen to the podcast that Jeff Swerink and I did on this claim that the Large Hadron Collider in France and Switzerland, the thing is so big it actually traverses two countries, has found that neutrinos travel faster than the velocity of light. So if you want all the details, go to the website, listen to Science News Flash. It's free. And actually, you can look at all the archived ones are there, too. We have hundreds of them up on our website, and so maybe you want to check out some of the other discoveries we've talked about as well. But the bottom line is that the Large Hadron Collider particle physicists did an experiment where they seemed to have found neutrinos moving at 2/100,000 faster than the velocity of light. So that's 2 parts in 100,000 faster than the velocity of light. And they released their preprint early saying, you know, this is such a startling find, and we've done the best we can to eliminate what we think would be the main systematic effects, and we wanted to get it out there before publication just to invite a critique. But one thing they did note is that this is in serious conflict with a discovery made back in 1987. What happened in 1987? A supernova exploded in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And now that drew a lot of excitement because astronomers had built these models on supernova eruptions where the models predict that there is going to be a huge eruption of neutrinos at the ignition of the supernova explosion. But, you know, until the 1980s, we didn't have detectors that be capable of picking up that stream of neutrinos. But one in a deep underground mine in Japan actually detected the neutrinos coming out of the 1987. I think they found, was 6 or 7 neutrinos. Not a lot. But they discovered that they were moving at the same velocity as the photons to within 1 part in 100 million. And so you got that 1987 test showing that neutrinos do not move faster than the velocity of light, or they move at the velocity of light to within 1 part in 100 million. And here's the Large Hadron Collider people saying, we think we're seeing neutrinos moving 0.002% faster than the velocity of light. And so they noted the conflict and said, you know, something's up. And, well, most physicists are convinced that there is some systematic thing. After all, the Large Hadron Collider is a complex instrument. And therefore, right now, they're trying to chase down what possible instrumental effects could be. The authors of the paper are convinced they've taken care of them all as best as they can. But, you know, I'm old enough to have seen a number of reports like this come out in the physics literature over the past 30, 40 years. And every time someone's made an announcement of this fashion, it hasn't been an instrumental effect, it's been a mathematical effect. In other words, it boils down to the something happening in the experiment where they're actually moving, seeing a mathematical point move faster than the velocity of light rather than a physical object. And when you're doing physics experiments, it's sometimes quite difficult to determine the difference between a physical entity and a mathematical point associated with that entity. This is all over the web, and it's saying now we can go faster than the velocity of light. Star Trek has got it right all along. We really can go warp 9. Or we can travel back in time and see what life was like at the time of Julius Caesar. All this kind of stuff is going on. And indeed, if it was possible for physical objects to be accelerated greater than the velocity of light, these kinds of speculations begin to have some meaning. Not really, of course, because as you accelerate a massive body towards the velocity of light, the energy in the system goes up to infinity. So you wind up with either infinite mass or infinite energy, neither of which is a pleasant experience. So it's still true, even if this were to pan out, that you're not going to get the Star Trek thing to work for you, or go back in time, or go forward in time. But most physicists are convinced this is going to go away, because every time this has been announced in the past, it has gone away. Now, let me tell you the difference, because Einstein's theory of relativity does permit mathematical points to go faster than the velocity of light, to go from less than the velocity of light and to be accelerated past the velocity of light. It just rules out physical objects being accelerated at greater than the velocity of light. Now, let me give you an analogy, and we did this in the podcast. You're at the beach. The beach isn't far away. Okay, let's find a beach where you have a shoreline, that is where the water makes contact with the dry sand, that's perfectly straight. So think of a nice straight line here. Or let me just go to the screen here and say this is a shoreline here, the bottom of the screen. And now you've got a wave moving towards the shoreline. But the wave is moving towards the shoreline at an angle to the shoreline. Now, when we're talking about a mathematical point, it's that point where the crest of the wave makes contact with the shoreline. And that mathematical point can move along this shoreline. As I make this angle arbitrarily small, that mathematical point will go up to infinite velocity, even though the wave is only moving, say, at 3 miles an hour. So the physical stuff is moving at 3 miles an hour, but that mathematical point where the crest of the wave makes contact with the shoreline could be moving at 100 times the velocity of light. No violation of relativity. And as I said in the past, when I've seen physicists make announcements that we think we found something being accelerated past the velocity of light, after a few months or a couple of years, it winds up, well, we really were measuring a mathematical point. And I think what's been especially fascinating is computer scientists have been looking at the question, can we capture these mathematical points to build computers that think faster than the velocity of light? You know, technically, there should be some way to make that happen, right? I mean, if we can have that mathematical point store information, then we should be able to make computers go faster than the velocity of light, and wouldn't that be wonderful for all of us? We can now have faster computers in smaller packages. Well, for about 15 years, computer scientists have been trying to do that very thing, but what they discovered is it's impossible to build an interface between that mathematical point moving at, say, 10 times the velocity of light and actually making it do something useful in the computer. And it's tantalizing because they can see the information flowing there, but they can't capture it in a way that they can use it. So bottom line is, we can't even make computers faster than the velocity of light. You can't think faster than the velocity of light, let alone move an object at greater than the velocity of light. But something else that's in Einstein's theory. If the universe is created with particles that are already moving at greater than the velocity of light, that does not violate relativity. Relativity will say inertia will be maintained. So, for example, if God, in creating the universe, were to create particles that were moving twice the velocity of light, they would maintain that velocity throughout the history of the universe. And so for 50 years now, physicists have been speculating that maybe in the cosmic creation event, there are these faster-than-light particles. So they're looking for those things. And they have a name. They're called tachyons. So these are speculative particles, but nobody's ever found any evidence for tachyons. And so I remember as a kid, that was a really fervent field of research. You know, let's use our astronomical tools and see if we can find these particles. Well, we're not finding them anywhere. We're not finding them in places where they should exist if they really do exist. And so now people have given up and said, it looks like the Creator didn't make any faster than light particles. Everything is less than the velocity of light. So that's kind of a summary of what you're going to hear on the podcast. And one of the things we said in that podcast is, this is a good reason not to shut down the Fermi particle accelerator. Outside of Chicago is what was once the world's largest particle accelerator. It's 4 miles long. And the way particle accelerators work, the longer the particle acceleration chamber, the more powerful the energy stream that you get out. Well, the one in Switzerland and France is 17 miles long. So it's four times as powerful as the one outside of Chicago. On the other hand, it's important, in my opinion, to keep the Fermi lab running. There are people in our government, for example, so we could save a lot of money if we shut down Fermi. And after all, the U.S. is heavily invested in the one that's in France and Switzerland. So it's like, why do we need this thing? We need it to confirm these kinds of results or to falsify these results. You know, the way to really try to root out possible systematic errors or chasing of mathematical points is to repeat the experiment on a separate instrument, an instrument that's different enough where you're going to have distinguishing instrumental effects. And Fermi is a little bit different, not a whole lot different, but different enough that it'd be worthwhile to repeat the experiment on Fermi. And by the way, that's exactly what's happening. People at Fermi are saying, let's do the same kind of neutrino result and see what we get. And if it doesn't go fast in velocity of light, then they know they're chasing some systematic effect. But personally, I think it's good to keep Fermi going just for that very reason on a number of experiments, because of the Large Hadron Collider comes out with another outrageous result that needs to be confirmed. Now, I'll tell you, as an astronomer, the rule of thumb in astronomy, nobody believes any discovery that you publish unless someone else sees it with a different telescope. And so, for that reason, I think we need to use the same principle in particle physics. Always make sure the result is confirmed before you really begin to build it into your theories of particle physics. So the problem is, in particle physics, the instruments cost a lot more money than they do in astronomy. You know, for us, maybe you're investing $100,000. In particle physics, you're looking at $1 billion+. So it's not cheap. It's really the most expensive science that you can do. So, but nevertheless, I think it's worth investing in particle physics because of the fact that you're really studying the fundamentals of particle creation. And I can tell you as a Christian, what excites me is the fact that our best particle creation models are consistent with our best cosmic models. Because at the beginning of the universe, you've got particle concentration energies that are equivalent to what you see in these particle accelerators. In fact, they're even more. And so one of the motivations for building these big particle accelerators is you get to duplicate the energy density conditions that existed when the universe was less than 1/1,000,000,000 of a second old. And this is where we're getting our greatest advances in coming up with a unified field theory. In fact, it was thanks to the Fermi particle accelerator that physicists were able to completely unify their understanding of electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force. We now have particle accelerators powerful enough that we can duplicate the conditions of the universe when the universe had only 3 forces of physics instead of 4 forces of physics. And that's kind of where cosmology and particle physics come together, because our best cosmic models tell us that the universe begins with only 1 force of physics. Then that force separates into 2, then 3, then 4. You haven't heard of them. It's gravity. electromagnetism and the strong and weak nuclear force. So at 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the cosmic creation event, gravity separates out from the strong electroweak force. And then when the universe is about a millionth of a trillionth of a second old, this is when the strong nuclear, 10 to the minus 33 or 34 seconds old, that's when the strong nuclear force separates out from the electroweak force. And when the universe is about a millionth of a trillionth of a second old, this is when the weak nuclear force separates out from electromagnetism. We've totally observed and have got all the theory and observations we need to understand the unification of electromagnetism with a weak nuclear force. Part of the motivation for building the Large Hadron Collider was to get deeper understanding of the next step of unification, where the electroweak force separates out from the strong nuclear force. We're not there yet, and to get there, you would need a particle accelerator 40 trillion miles long to go all the way back to 10 to the minus 34 seconds.
Next year's budget.
So, well, as Alan Guther used to joke, that won't happen until we have a Democrat in the president's office and we have Democrats controlling both houses of Congress. But even then, I think they would be strained to try to fund that to kind of an instrument. So, okay, anyway, go to the podcast. You'll hear a lot more details. But the bottom line is, whenever you hear a discovery like this, that, quote, would require a total revision of all of our understanding of fundamental physics, it's best to take a wait-and-see approach, especially when you've got other observations that contradict what they're seeing. That's exactly what we're dealing with here. So both Jeff and I think this is going to go away. On the other hand, if it doesn't go away, it would mean that we're seeing something different with exotic mass particles than we are seeing with ordinary mass particles. And in some particle creation models that are already being researched, that's exactly what they predict. Not quite an effect that big, 2 parts in 100,000, but they do predict that there would be subtle changes in the way the laws of physics would operate when you're dealing with exotic mass particles as opposed to ordinary mass particles. And neutrinos are exotic mass particles. We call them exotic because, unlike protons, neutrons, and electrons, they do not interact well with photons. We call them WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. And believe it or not, the physicists actually trademarked that name, WIMPs, because they were afraid some company like Motorola or General Electric might want to call one of their instruments a WIMP. I don't think there's any worry about that. But nevertheless, they've already trademarked it to make sure that that doesn't happen. But they have failed to trademark the term macho. To me, it's worth trademarking macho. Don't worry about WIMP. So now we've got a couple of questions here. Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, Dr. Ross, I probably knew it one time, but I've forgotten. How do they measure the speed of light?
Well, the way it was done accurately for the first time was actually right here in the San Gabriel Mountains, where they put a light beam emanating out from Mount Wilson over to Mount Baldy and back. And so they basically measured how much time it would take a light interferometer to go between those two mountains and back. And they measured it both ways, and that's called the Michelson-Morley experiment, which confirmed that Einstein's theory of relativity was indeed right, that it doesn't matter whether you start from Mount Wilson and go to Mount Baldy or start at Mount Baldy and go to Mount Wilson. They thought they were going to see a difference. And the fact that they saw no difference at all, Rudy told them that the velocity of the emanator of the light isn't a factor. And this is kind of what led to Einstein to develop this theory of special relativity. So I'll tell you this. He hated that term. He preferred that his theory be called the theory of invariance, which means the velocity of the observer doesn't matter. But that was the first experiment was done right here. But there's other ways you can measure the velocity of light. You can measure it in astronomy, too, because in astronomy, we can look at spectral lines. And there's certain spectral lines that will split into two. And the degree to which they split into two is dependent on the velocity of light. And so, for example, the Bible makes frequent claims that the laws of physics don't change from the cosmic creation event until the end of all evil. They will change when God conquers and removes evil once and for all. Well, as long as evil is around, the laws of physics don't change. And one of the ways we can confirm that is by looking at the light from a quasar that's 12, 13 billion light years away. And we look for those split spectral lines, and they tell us that the velocity of light 12 billion years ago, 13 billion years ago, is identical to the velocity of light today. There's been no change. But in terms of the really accurate measurements, they're basically done kind of similar to what took place up here in the mountains. And they can now measure the velocity of light to about 15 places the decimal. So we have very accurate measurements for the velocity of light. And even when we're measuring them in distant stars and galaxies, the precision is quite high. And so we've been able to demonstrate that indeed the Bible predicted it correctly, that the laws of physics don't change. And by the way, it's a good thing they don't change. Any change in the velocity of light or the history of the universe would rule out the possibility for life. Your life depends on the velocity of light being a particular value. It affects certain things in quantum mechanics, also affects the energy balance of the universe. Okay, can we move on? All right. Let's get to this subject of the origin of humanity. And let me give you a couple of passages of Scripture just to remind you. We've read these before, but it's been a long time. I'll just pick a few. We're actually looking at Psalm 139. And if you're new to the class, what we're doing is we're going through the 27 chapter length or longer creation texts that we find in the Bible. But Psalm 139, the whole focus of its creation message is human beings. So this is really the most in-depth passage on humans, human origins you'll find anywhere in the Bible. I'll just read a portion from this. And this is a psalm of King David. And he says, starting in verse 12, "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be." And this is making the point that God was personally involved in your birth and development, not just from the time you came into the womb, but for the time you were actually conceived. And this is a point that is brought out in Psalm 51, verse 5. "Surely I've been a sinner from birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me." And this is really the biblical reason why Christians do not support abortion. Because what this text is telling us, in combination with Psalm 139, we became a spiritual being at the point of conception, not at the point of coming out of the womb of the mother. And so we took on the image of God at the very time we were conceived. So at that point, we become a physical being, we become a soulish being, we become a spiritual being. That's Psalm 51, verse 5, and I'll give you a cross-reference. It's Isaiah 49, verse 5, so just remember the fives. "And now the Lord says, he who formed me in the womb to be his servant." So there it's making the point that at the moment of conception, we were formed to be the servant of God. Just like God gave us the birds and the mammals to serve and please us, he created us to serve and please him. And I made that that origin literally goes back to the time that we were conceived.
That was Psalm 139.
That was Isaiah 49, verse 5. Psalm 51, verse 5. And then Psalm 139. Those are the three texts that Christians use to support the idea that we are fully human from the time that we are conceived. That's when we take on the image of God. That's when we become a spiritual being. And God is intimately involved in that process. It's not just the father and the mother. It's the father, the mother. The father and mother are responsible for our physical attributes, but God is the one that endows us with the spirit. And that's when he begins counting the number of days that we will live. And so God knew before we were conceived in the womb how many days we would spend here on planet Earth. He knows the day of our conception. He knows the day of our death, our departure. It's all written on his calendar. Okay. Now, we've been struggling trying to get through this keynote I've been developing on human origins. And where we picked up last time is we're kind of going through the different species of bipedal primates that predate human beings. You've got the Homo sapiens idaltu, which is basically a tropical kind of Neanderthal. You've got the Neanderthals, and then there's Homo erectus, who evolutionists consider to be the progenitor of both Neanderthal and human beings, although in the recent scientific literature, they're now doubting that any of these species, idaltu, Neanderthal, or Homo erectus, had anything to do with a lineage leading to human beings. As I pointed out before, with the discovery of all these different species of bipedal primates, we're not seeing any kind of phylogenetic tree. It's a phylogenetic bush. Let me just kind of go back to that one here. What we're seeing is that the fossil record doesn't look like the standard evolutionary tree. Rather, it looks like a hedge or a bush or a lawn, depending on the analogy that you like. And every time they find a new species of a bipedal primate, it adds chaos to the naturalistic model. And the latest one being Australopithecus sediba. That's it. Fuzz has done two podcasts on Australopithecus sediba, so you can listen to those. And there's a couple of articles he's written as well. But it's the latest example of where a new find kind of threw everything into chaos, because this is a creature that was late upon the scene, just 2 million years old, and yet had a smaller cranial capacity, a smaller brain than the bipedal primates that preceded by a large measure. And so, yeah, Homo sapiens idaltu is not human. By the way, our title is Homo sapiens sapiens. We're not Homo sapiens. We're Homo sapiens sapiens. We think twice rather than just once, I guess, is what they're saying. But we're not human. They're not human. They're kind of a tropical Neanderthal type, and they lived about 80 to 170,000 years ago. So far, no DNA recovered, mainly because we're looking at a tropical variety. And people ask me, well, how come we got DNA for Neanderthals, but we don't have DNA for Homo sapiens idaltu? Well, they lived in different climate zones. Moreover, the Neanderthal fossils we're finding are typically being found in caves where the bones are buried under a lot of sediment. And that's an ideal way to preserve the DNA. You're cutting off the oxygen, you're cutting off the bacteria, you're cutting off the heat and the water, and those are all things that degrade the DNA. Even so, the DNA of Neanderthal is considerably degraded. Every 1,000 years that goes by, you get degradation. But at last count, they've got mitochondrial DNA recovered from 20 specimens where the DNA is sufficiently intact that they can actually come up with some reasonable conclusions from it. Say, how reasonable? They believe that in these 20 specimens, that about two-thirds of the DNA is giving us a reliable indicator of the original DNA. So the corruption factor is about one-third, but they believe about two-thirds of it is to some extent pristine. But as you look at these 20 specimens, and they span somewhere between 80 and 100,000 years in time, and they're also from the entire geographical range of the Neanderthals. So we're talking from Spain all the way to Siberia. I don't have a map here about where the Neanderthals lived, but basically it was the southern portion of Europe and the southern portion of Siberia is the place where Neanderthals dwelt. We see no evolution of DNA. This is a serious problem for all the evolutionary models, because we look at the oldest DNA samples and compare it with the most recent, we can't detect any significant alteration or change in the DNA. Well, 80 to 100,000 years, and being somewhat equivocal because the dating is a big issue right now. Typically, you're not looking at radiometric dates. You're looking at thermoluminescence or optical luminescence dates. and often they're dating the sediment where they are using radiometric dates, and there we have to presume that the date of the sediment is the same as the date of the bones. That may be true, but it may not be true. Bottom line is, when you look at the dates for these bipedal primates, typically at best you're getting an error bar of 20 to 30%, and at worst it can be 400 or 500%. So the dates are in dispute. And you say, well, how come evolutionists aren't realizing that this is a serious challenge to their model? Basically, it's because of the dating. They're saying, well, maybe we're not really looking at 100,000 years. Maybe we're only looking at 50,000 years. But even in 50,000 years, if you're going to sustain the idea that the human species is the product of natural descent from, say, Homo erectus that split off into Neanderthal and human beings, in 50,000 years, you better see something happening in the DNA that's of a significant nature, and we're not. And then we look at the DNA of Neanderthal and compare it with that of human beings. The difference is right now measured to be 1%. It could wind up being more than that 1%. It's not less than that 1%, but it could be more. That's because we don't have a complete comparison yet. But where we are having a comparison, looks like about a 1% difference. And that 1% difference is considered to be so significantly large that these Neanderthal must be a species distinct from human beings. Because if they were somehow part of the human lineage or the human species, we wouldn't see that degree of distinctiveness. And then there's a distinct morphology. In fact, Dave, while he was up here, said, I'm not a Neanderthal because I can cry. Neanderthals don't have tear ducts, which is probably why they couldn't live in the tropics, is one reason why if you don't have tear ducts, you better not be living in a place that's dry and sandy, because your eyes will get irritated in a hurry. But not having tear ducts is actually an advantage where you're living in a really cold climate. Because one of the problems of being a human being, and I've seen this in Canada, I've been out in places where it's 50 below, and I don't know whether you've ever been in a cold place, but your eyes tend to tear right away. And when it's that cold, they freeze. Your eyes can freeze shut, and it's quite painful to try to open them. And that's one of the things you learn when you're in a really cold place. You want to gradually transition from your nice warm cabin, where it's 70 degrees above, to going outside where it's 50 below. And what you want to do is stop the tearing. So you want to kind of gradually get used to the temperature getting colder and colder so that tearing won't cause a problem. And the other thing you've got to be careful about is make sure you don't breathe that cold air in. If you're used to breathing in warm air and suddenly you breathe in cold air, it will literally burn your lungs and you'll get lung damage. And so once again, you've got to kind of slowly transition. And you want to wear one of these parkas with a hood where you've got a little tube coming out like this. That makes it tough because your peripheral vision really gets knocked out. But I'll tell you, without that tube, you're not going to be warming that cold air sufficiently, so when it hits your nose, by the time it gets to your nose, you want it less than 40 below. Because if it's still 40 below and it hits your nose, you're going to cause damage to your nostrils, your lungs, everything else. That wasn't a problem for Neanderthal, because Neanderthal had this enormous nasal capacity. And that enormous nasal capacity allowed the cold air that Neanderthal was breathing in to warm up sufficiently that by the time it got to the throat and the lungs, it didn't cause any damage. And people who have studied this morphology acknowledge that Neanderthal, compared to all other mammals, has the highest nasal capacity to body mass ratio. Nothing gets anywhere close to Neanderthal. In fact, one paper I read said the difference is so extreme that it's impossible to link Neanderthal in with any other mammal species, and acknowledge that that was a challenge to the evolutionary paradigm. Where did Neanderthal get that enormous nasal capacity if we don't see it in any other bipedal primate, and we don't see it in human beings as well? Now, we were able to beat out the Neanderthals because we, as soon as we showed up, clothing. That's one thing you notice. The DNA dates for the origin of human beings is the same date you get for the origin of clothing. And you actually see this in the Bible. Now, here's God creating Adam and Eve. They sin. What does he do? He makes fur clothes for them. And this is something we find in the most ancient human sites, is that they had needles. with holes at the bottom so that they could sow. And they were evidently taking advantage of rodents and taking the pelts of rodents, sewing them together to make clothes. And that was happening right away. And one of the things they noticed is that the earliest humans, compared to the latest Neanderthals, were living sometimes in climate zones 15 degrees centigrade colder than what Neanderthal could tolerate. That's because even though our bodies are very poorly designed for a cold climate, we can overcome that through technology, through wearing the appropriate clothing and doing the appropriate practices. In other words, you're in a nice warm cave with a fire, and you gradually transition to the cold that is outside. Neanderthal evidently didn't have the intellectual capacity to develop that kind of behavior, didn't have clothing, but had the right morphology to deal with a cold climate. And I think that's something we don't always appreciate. We human beings are beautifully designed in terms of our anatomy for a hot climate. We're not designed for a cold climate. And therefore, because we're using clothing, we can strip down when it's hot and we can put the clothing on when it's warm. We can live everywhere. But if you're designed for a cold climate, then you have a problem going to the tropics because you'll heat up. And the problem with heating up is you'll cook your brain. So we have a body that allows us to keep our brain cool, given its huge size, even when it's very warm, mainly because we're bipedal, we're tall, we're slim. It means not a lot of heat falls on our back from the sun. That's the one wonderful thing about walking upright, is that when the sun shines down on you in the tropics, the sun is virtually overhead. All that gets exposed is your head. Wear a hat, you'll be fine. And then the rest of you is shaded. So if you wear the appropriate hat where the sun is directly overhead, literally your whole body is shaded. And the other thing about human beings that's different from what we see with all other large-bodied mammals, with the exception of the horse, is that we are able to perspire very efficiently. And so we're able to keep our bodies cool because of the amazing hydration system that our Creator gave us. As I say, the only other mammal that has that's a large body size, is the horse. But I think God did that on purpose. In fact, I have to talk about that here in this book, where it mentions the horse in chapter 39 of Job, that God gave us a horse to be a personal transportation animal and wanted to make sure that the horse was able to go everywhere we go, and so also gave the horse this amazing hydration system. As long as you give your horse lots to drink, it can go with you into a hot place, just like you need a lot to drink. By the way, we're very poorly adapted for a hot climate where we got no water. If you've got no water, you're in real trouble with a human being, because we perspire so efficiently that you quickly dehydrate. But as long as you've got water, you're okay. And so, yeah, if you want to go hiking out into, what's that wonderful park we got just east of here where they have all Joshua Tree. If you want to go to Joshua Tree in the first week of August, you want to take several gallons of water with you. And I can tell you from personal experience, having been in Africa and other very hot places in the world, you can actually be drinking a quart of water every 20 minutes. That's how efficiently your body will release water to the environment. And that means if you're in a really hot place like that, that's the kind of water content you've got to take with you. And often people don't take enough water. Same thing's true of the horse. And incidentally, the other amazing thing about the horse, it doesn't mind you putting clothes on it. You know, a lot of creatures don't like clothes. Try putting some clothes on a cat, okay, and see how far you get. Dogs will barely tolerate it. In fact, what they've been doing is breeding clothing-tolerant dogs. I couldn't believe this, but there's actually a bunch of breeders out there that are working on trying to come up with a breed of dog that will tolerate being all dressed up in frilly little clothes by their female owners.
These are marketing companies, right?
Well, that's something else that you actually see about dogs, is that they have a DNA that allows them to be designer creatures. There's really no other animal like that. You can take dogs and basically design them to your heart's content. And we human beings do that. They weren't like that originally, but God gave them the DNA that we could make them into all different kinds of shapes, colors, sizes, personalities, and even clothing tolerant. But the horse is naturally clothing tolerant. And so if you want to take your horse into a place where it's 50 below, you can, you know, put clothing on the horse, and the horse will accept the clothing. Takes to it quite naturally. So anyway, the horse was specially designed, in my opinion, for human beings. And as I talk about in the book of Job, compare the horse to the donkey, compare the horse to the camel, and you'll see how ideally designed it was to be a human transportation animal. I mean, if I were to ride a donkey, my feet would drag on the ground unless I pulled my feet up. And I can't take a lot of gear with me because the donkey just isn't that big. On the other hand, if you go up on a camel, you'll be so high off the ground, and the camel is so wobbly compared to the horse, you've got a high probability of slipping off or being... I mean, have you ever watched people ride camels? They're really expert. It takes a lot of practice and getting to know the animal in order to be able to ride that creature safely. And if you fall off, you will injure yourself. Whereas falling off a horse, you'll get hurt, but you're not facing imminent death. So that's a sidetrack. I got some questions here. Go ahead.
Back on Neanderthals, is there any evidence that they were furry? Since they didn't wear clothes and they were in a cold climate,
Well, the evidence is disputed, but what you do see in the scientific literature is some indication that they were very fair-skinned, red hair, and they did have quite a bit of body hair. But it is disputed evidence. But one reason why people think it's reasonable, having fair skin would mean that they'd be able to absorb vitamin D more efficiently, be able to make vitamin D more efficiently from sunlight. And, you know, being in a northern clime, having fair skin would be an advantage as opposed to being in the tropics. And then having a little bit of extra body hair would help keep them warm. But, as I said, this is disputed. We're not certain exactly what color the hair was or how much hair they had. They find some evidence for that, but they're not even certain it's actually from the Neanderthal. It might be from the creatures they were eating, because one of the things that Neanderthal was good at was hunting large-bodied bird and mammal creatures. And so, but, you know, that has certainly been suggested in the scientific literature, that they may have been a little bit hairier than we are. I had that problem when I was ministering in Japan. In fact, they told me in Japan, never wear a short-leaf shirt. They'll see all of your body hair, and they'll presume you're of Neanderthal descent, and therefore, you're not really the most intelligent person around. So, and they said, but by all means, don't wear a hat, because your bald head is a sign that you're not hairy. So, but, you know, that's just some of the biases that happen when you're traveling around the world. But one of the things I've noticed traveling around the world is like every national group thinks they're the best in the world. So I went to China, they think they're the best. When you talk to the Jews, they think they're the best. When you talk to the Armenians, they think they're the best. Everybody thinks they're the best. In fact, my ancestors from the highlands of Scotland, they thought they were the best. So just seems to be a feature. But of course, what does the Bible say? We're all created equal in the eyes of God, men and women, and all different kids. Anyways, there are some other questions here. Yes?
How far apart is the DNA of donkeys and horses?
It's very close. The DNA of donkeys and horses, in fact, the morphology is so close. As we all know, you can take a donkey and a horse and you can get an offspring, a mule. By the way, that only happens under human control. You won't see that happening in the wild. But, you know, human beings can force the issue. You basically take away all options except the donkey or the horse, and you'll get the mule. And see, that's a challenge to the evolutionary paradigm, in the sense that evolutionists thought the donkey and the horse must have a recent common ancestor because of how similar their morphology is and the fact that you can actually get offspring from forced mating. However, when you look at the properties of the mind of the horse and the personality and the mind of the horse and compared to the donkey, they couldn't be more different. And one of the papers I quote in this book here is a study that came out of UCLA that said if the evolutionary paradigm is correct, then the same kind of similarity you see at the morphological level would have to be mirrored at the level of personality and the mind. In the case of the donkey and the horse, that's certainly not true. And what Job 39 points out is just how differently the donkey relates to human beings in terms of its personality than the horse does. In the case of the donkey, by the way, both creatures are able to form strong emotional bonds with human beings. They're both highly motivated to relate and serve human beings. But the way the donkey serves a human being is to do everything it can to keep you safe, which is why you use donkeys when you're going down another Grand Canyon. You know, it's a steep trail on the edge of a cliff. But the donkey is sure-footed and is highly motivated to make sure you stay safe. And so if you run around a dangerous corner, it will back up and won't take you there. That's its motivation. The horse is the opposite. The horse likes danger. It likes risk. It likes adventure. And so if you're of the adventuresome, risk-taking type, go with a horse. Or as it says in the book of Job, the horse has no fear of spears and arrows. Now, try riding a donkey into battle. As soon as that donkey sees the spears and arrows, it heads in the opposite direction. And so that's why people have never used donkeys in war. They do use mules, but they only use mules to haul supplies. And the mule has a little bit of the personality of the horse, where it's willing to withstand some danger, but you certainly can't take it into battle. But the horse, you definitely can. But you know, there you can see just how different the motivations are in terms of how they relate to human beings. But you know what's interesting? Both the horse and the donkey will lay down their life for the human owner. They have such a strong affinity for human beings, where a strong emotional bond is formed. They literally value the life of their human owner more than they do their own life. So there again, how can you explain that from an evolutionary perspective? Yeah, go ahead, Al.
Yeah, a couple of things. You might have heard about this, but they took some hair from an aborigine, and research has found, you know, with the genes and all that, that instead of one single wave out of Africa, like the thing that they take now, there's a new model that has two waves. One, the ancestors of the aborigines came out about 70,000 years ago, and then there was another wave later on, about 24,000 years later, that became the East Asians and Europeans. So, looks like, I don't know if you read about this. It's just kind of like a new model of our migration out of Africa. Also, I have another question.
Well, let me stop there, because that's actually a fairly old model, and it's a model that has been replaced because the evidence for the 60 to 70,000 year aborigines in Australia is all based on a single cave, the Jimnian Cave in Australia. And for years they've been quoting this date as 60 to 70,000 years, but it turns out it's an optical luminescence date. And optical luminescence dating is kind of equivalent to, well, I'll just give you a story. When our sons were really young, what I did is I put on the ceilings of both of their bedrooms the star patterns. I had the Big Dipper there and the pointer star to the North Star, because I wanted them to get used to the idea that if you're ever lost or outside at night, you can use that to figure out which is true north. And so I had these phosphorescent stars on their ceilings. But I had another motive in mind. Because, you know, we would put them to bed, and often we would notice that the light would go on and they'd be reading and whatever, and they weren't really going to sleep at the appropriate time. With school the next day, we were concerned. And I'd walk into the room and it'd be dark. I'd look up at the ceiling and I'd say, hey, you know, those things are bright. And so that told me that they really had the lights on. And so they were busted, right? but the whole point there is that depending on the strength of the light, those phosphorescent stars will dim at a faster or slower rate. And basically what it gives you is an upper limit to how the date for that the particular species. So in terms of the Jimnian Cave, if all you look at is the optical luminescence, It's basically telling you they're 60 to 70,000 years old or a whole lot younger. It's an upper limit. It can't be more than 60 to 70,000 years, but it could be less. But you can go online on our website. I think you have to go to our old website. It's www.old.reasons.org to get all of our old articles, because this discovery goes back, 15 years. You'll see an article I wrote to the effect where they went to the Jimian cave, and for the first time, they were able to do radiometric dating. And it turned out that they're looking at 3,000 years, not 60,000 years. It literally dropped the date by a factor of 20. And so it's disappeared from the scientific literature as this claim that the Aborigines got into Australia 60,000 years ago. And that date was always suspicious because the geography to make an easy passage to Australia wasn't in place 60,000 years ago. If you're talking 30,000 years or 20,000 years, it was. And so the thinking now is that the Aborigines first arrived in Australia, probably no earlier than 25,000 years ago. So that's kind of the bottom line on that. But you can read about it on our website.
They used hair. I mean, this is new research. And they used hair from that and did the genome study. Have they ever found where Neanderthal came? Did they come from Africa also in their DNA?
No, the only data we got Neanderthals. Yeah, this will be the last question because I want to get on to Homo erectus. Okay, we're actually going to get to Homo erectus today. But Neanderthals have only been found in southern Europe and southern Siberia. We have DNA for them. We have DNA for humans, but that's the limit of our DNA evidence. And so, although they're now thinking they might be able to get DNA from these hobbit creatures in Indonesia, they're still trying to work on that. That's a possibility because they're only looking like 18 to 30,000 years ago. And there's this Denisova man, but a lot of people think they're just simply Neanderthals. So in that sense, we can't compare the DNA with, say, Homo erectus. But when we compare it to humans, we do see that distinction with Homo erectus. You're looking at specimens that date between 200,000 years ago and 1.8 million years ago. And by the way, in terms of relatively complete skeletons, it's humans, Neanderthals, and Homo erectus, and that's it. For all other species, we're talking about portions of the skeleton rather than close to the entire skeleton. And often when they're identifying a species, like with Denisova man, we're talking one portion of one digit of the hand. That's it. That's all they got. Now, in terms of Homo erectus, there's no DNA. Now, Homo erectus lived in a warmer climate zone. So given that we're talking 200,000 to 1.8 million years, there is no expectation that we'll have useful DNA. It's not that we don't have DNA, it's that the DNA is so utterly corrupted that it's useless for doing any kind of science. So all we really have are the bones. But when you look at the bones, it's clear that it's a distinct morphology. I mean, if you were to go back into the textbooks 30 years ago, they were saying Homo erectus was so similar to human beings and Neanderthals that that would be the ancestor for both humans and Neanderthals, that somehow they split off. But if you actually look at the fossils, what you discover is that they're a maximum of 5 feet tall. They were very slender compared to both Neanderthals and humans. They weighed only about half of our body weight. Their brain was only 800 cubic centimeters maximum. The human average is about 1,600. But their brain was considerably bigger than the Australopithecines. Australopithecines comes in at about 405 up to about 480. But Homo erectus comes in at 800. By the way, this is the step function challenge to the evolutionary paradigm. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Where when you look at brain size, it's static, jumps up, static, and jumps up. It's not kind of a smooth linear progression. You see these step functions. And one of those step functions is what you see for Homo erectus. It jumps from 4 to 500 cc's all the way up to 800. And then it jumps from there up to 1,600. But the morphology of Homo erectus is so very different from both humans and Neanderthals that they've been ruled out as a possible ancestor to both of them. And I think what's most interesting is when you compare the skeletons that are the most ancient with those that are the most recent, we don't see any significant change. Now, again, if you're trying to support some kind of naturalistic evolutionary model, you'd expect to see change in both the bones and the DNA with respect to time, and we're not seeing that. Now, last week, I promised that I would explain why God would go to all the trouble of making 10 or 12 species of bipedal primates before he created human beings. I mean, from a biblical perspective, you say, why go to all that trouble? Why not just put human beings on the scene and be done with it? Well, as you look at these multiple species of bipedal primates, we see that progressively they're a little better equipped in terms of their body strength and their tool use at hunting large-bodied bird and mammal species. And moreover, what you see as you go from those that lived 6.5 million years ago up to, say, Neanderthals that were living 50 to 100,000 years ago, is that by the time you get to Neanderthals, it looks like 90% plus of their diet is large-bodied bird and mammal species. And so you see this growing specialization focusing on the meat of large-bodied bird and mammal species. Now, there's a new update in this research that I want to report to you about, because some of the data that was published 10 years ago has now been replaced. But what paleontologists have done is kind of looked at mammal extinctions, large-bodied mammal extinctions that took place when human beings entered that region. So, for example, when human beings came into Australia, very quickly, 94% of all the species of large-bodied bird and mammals disappeared, mainly because the humans came in and started eating everything. I mean, after all, I mean, if you want to, you know, keep your family going for a while, just knock off a mastodon, and you've got 4,000 meals, right? You don't have to do much. So it's an easy way of life. And likewise, when humans invaded South America, we see an extinction rate of 79%, North America 73%, Europe 30%, Asia 14%, and Sub-Saharan Africa, it's only 4.5%. Now, to give you some background on this, Sub-Saharan Africa had all the species of bipedal primates except for the Neanderthals. And look at the low extinction rate. Australia, South America, and North America, we got zero evidence of bipedal primates. And so the problem there for the large-bodied bird and mammal species, they had no previous exposure to two-legged creatures that are intent on eating them, and eating them with fairly sophisticated tool use. And therefore, when humans showed up on the scene with very advanced tools and, you know, a great hydration system so that they could hunt them in the heat of the day, which is kind of the favorite tactic of the first humans, they took advantage of their cooling system to go after these animals when it was hottest. And by the way, that has two advantages. I mean, it's easy to run down the herbivore creatures because they will get heat exhaustion quickly, where you won't. And it's also a time when you don't have to worry about the lions and the tigers. It's too hot for them to go after you, so they're all taking a nap under a shady tree. Meanwhile, you can go off and hunt these creatures. But the first humans were so efficient at doing this that except for those regions that had some ability to adapt to this future shock, they literally got wiped out. And you say, how come the extinction rate wasn't so bad for North America? It was a bigger continent, which meant that these creatures had more places to hide than they did, say, in Australia. Because the problem with Australia is you've got that huge desert where these creatures don't want to go, and you've got this narrow strip of land with all these aborigines running around with spears in their hands, and so they wound up getting wiped out. Literally 94% of all the species were there that got wiped out. Less in North and South America. But notice, North America, South America, and Australians, the humans that settled there, after millennia, never advanced in their technology. They never got out of the Stone Age. No invention of the wheel. You know, they weren't able to get into any kind of organized cultivation, and their technology didn't significantly advance. Europe had only a 30% extinction rate, Asia and Sub-Sahara Africa more so. But one of the things you'll find here in the Hidden Treasures of Job is that when humans invaded Australia, South America, North America, they wiped out the top 10. Job 39 and 38 kind of gives you the most important species of mammals and birds that God gave us to launch and sustain our civilization. The Europeans, the Asians, and the Sub-Saharan Africans had these creatures, and therefore they were able to launch and sustain advancing high-technology civilization. That didn't happen in Australia, South America, North America, because they wiped out the very animals that God gave them to accomplish that purpose. And it wasn't really until the Europeans and the Asians came into Australia, North and South America, that the technology changed. You know, it wasn't that the Aborigines were stupid. They lacked the animals that God gave them to launch and sustain civilization. Incidentally, this is now having an impact on the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life. Astronomers are beginning to realize, you know, we got a bigger problem than just trying to find a planet with human beings on it or the equivalent. We also have to find a planet that has all these sophisticated animals that are necessary to get you out of the Stone Age. By the way, our need for these animals today is very different. And I think that's one of the more exciting things in my research on this book, is realizing God designed these top 10 animals to launch and sustain civilization at the beginning of humanity, but to fulfill a very different purpose at the end of human civilization. So as you look at these creatures, they're serving a completely different purpose today than that they did at the beginning of human civilization. And it's like God knew ahead of time what our needs would be when we have global high technology civilization compared to what they would be when we lack that, and in advance designed these animals to fulfill these two very different purposes in each case. Hopefully that'll give you some motivation to kind of look at what's in that book. You can go over there and read it without buying it if you really are curious. So I think my 10 minutes are up. But what I'm going to get into next time is what it takes to get these animals. You can't bring them on the cosmic scene right away. It really explains why we see the fossil record laid out the way it is. Because in order to get these advanced birds and mammals, you need a certain history of life before that. So just like we need these animals to do what God wants us to do, likewise these animals can't do their thing unless there's a certain previous history of life before them. It really does explain why the fossil record looks the way it does. And you know, over there I've got a book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. We are planning to bring out a book, Why the Fossil Record is the Way It Is. But it's all the whole fossil record, the whole history of life, is designed by God to make it possible for us human beings to launch and sustain global high-technology civilization. Why does he want us to do that? That's how we're going to fulfill the Great Commission. Take the good news of Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world so we can leave this creation and be ushered into a completely new creation with different laws of physics. You can read about that and why the universe is the way it is. So that's a little teaser what we'll talk about next week. By the way, I've also been on staff for 35-plus years. Ken Cromings joined the staff 3 months after I did. And I'm going to ask you not to hold me here because I think it's really important for me to get over there to his reception. So that's just a little request. But next week you can ask me all the questions you want after class. All right, let me bow in prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this time we've had in your word. Thank you for this wonderful age in which we live, in which we're making all these discoveries that reveal why you penned what you have, inspired what you have in the Psalms and in Job, the different creation accounts that we see throughout the books of the Bible. Thank you, Lord, for giving us so many creation accounts. And thank you, Lord, for giving us the technology that we can read the book of nature in the depth that we can today. Father, I pray you would give us the humility and the grace, Lord, to not overlook what you're revealing to us. Lord, would we have the humility to see what you're trying to communicate to us, we would receive it as truth and really recognize your glory and righteousness revealed in the heavens and the earth and all earth's life. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.